I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Welcome to The Connection. There is nothing as pure and delightful and contagious as a baby laughing. In fact, I bet you're smiling, maybe even laughing now. I know I am. Our guest, stand-up comedian Chris Duffy, believes that having a sense of humor is a skill that can serve us through the ups and downs of life, the good times and the bad. In fact, it helped him teaching a bunch of rambunctious fifth graders in Boston, including 11-year-old Gary, whose hilarious reviews of the cafeteria lunches made him the official classroom food critic. Now, there are a bunch of scientific studies touting the benefits of laughter for relieving stress and pain, even boosting the immune system. Laughter brings us together. It's a social lubricant. It's why there are laugh tracks, so we don't feel like we're laughing all by ourselves. Chris Duffy has a podcast, How to Be a Better Human, and has written for TV, including for Wyatt Cenac. And he joins us today on The Connection to talk about how laughing more can make you present, creative, connected, and happy, which happens to be the subtitle of his book. And Chris Duffy, nice to have you with us today on The Connection.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
Well, we're very happy to have you, but I must say it feels like a very strange time, and maybe every day feels like a strange time to be talking about laughter when the news is so dire and we see, you know, so much suffering around the world and their daily crises, and there's so much upset and depression about the state of the country, the state of the world. How do you see humor in these dark times, these unfunny times, I would say?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. And it's one that I ask myself a lot. I think that for me, the reason why I believe so deeply in the power of humor and laughter is because of what it can do for us in exactly these kind of dark, unfunny times. I think that there's a sense that we only should like laugh when times are good. And I actually think that that's not when laughter serves us the most. To me, laughter is kind of the opposite of toxic positivity, which is the idea that, like, in every bad time, there's a silver lining in every cloud. Always look at the upside. I think humor can really help us to engage with the reality. We can sometimes laugh at how absolutely horrible things are. It's just bad. And to me, what laughter does is it relieves the tension. It allows us to connect with other people. And then it focuses us on what we can actually do to move forward. So often we laugh and we say, like, that's so true. So I think that often when times are really bad, laughter is what we need the most.
How would you describe your sense of humor? And there's so many different styles. There's a dark humor. There's a dry humor, observational humor. There's slapstick. There are people that pun all day long. How would you describe your humor? Where did it come from?
Yeah. You know, Marty, one of the funny things about humor is that in music, we have names for all the different genres, right? You could say, I love punk music, or I love classical music, or I love rock. And in humor and comedy, we just say comedy. We don't have like a name for the punk comedy versus the classical comedy. So I think because of that, sometimes people get turned off and say like, well, I didn't like that one thing, so I don't like any of it. For me, I try to, in the comedy that I make, be someone who brings people in, who makes people feel like they're seen. I like to tell stories. I like to talk about my real life. But in the humor that I like to encourage other people to do, one of the big things that I push people to think about is not necessarily being the center of attention, not necessarily being the one where everyone is looking at you and hearing your funny story and applauding, but rather the person who is laughing the most in a day. That might mean you're laughing at other people's jokes. That might mean you are just noticing funny things. That's what I really think is the type of humor that we need more of in the world. We don't need more people who want to be the center of attention.
Well, and I'm really glad you made that point, because I was thinking about, to have a sense of humor, on the one hand, to deliver a joke well, that's a sense of humor, but to be the recipient and to get the joke is sort of the flip side of that same sense of humor.
Absolutely. I mean, some scientists think this is why we as a species evolved humor, why humor exists across all human societies, is because it was such an important thing to be able to present a lock to someone else and have the other person be able to turn the key and to get the riddle and actually understand the joke and then laugh to show that they got it. And I think, you know, going back to your question of why humor is important in tough times, I think when times are scary, we tend to feel isolated and alone. And humor lets us know that we are not alone, lets us know that other people get it. When we are laughing together, we are so deeply connected. And I think that honestly, that can, in really tough times, be a political act, to be connected to other people really deeply and not afraid.
Let me just underscore what you were saying, because you were quoting from this cognitive psychologist at UCLA, a guy named Greg Bryant, who was talking about the sort of lock and key, that there's something about humor that is a code. It's a message you're sending to someone. And do they, to use your words, have the key to unlock that? A kind of secret language in a way.
Absolutely. So Dr. Greg Bryant has studied the evolution of laughter and humor, and he has this theory that really resonates with me called encryption theory. And he came across this in part because he did a study where he realized that people across cultures could immediately, with much more than random chance, identify a fake laugh. And he thought that's really interesting as an evolutionary scientist. Like, why would we all be able to know when someone is fake laughing? And the answer that he came up with is that it was very important to know whether someone was actually part of our group or not. And so if they're faking a laugh, it means that they don't actually have the hidden key to unlock the code. It means that they're pretending to, and that could be a dangerous thing. So that's why we might have evolved that.
Can you do a fake laugh for us?
You know, right. You hear that and you know, oh God, that guy is so fake. He's totally ridiculous. It's not real. He's trying to ingratiate himself with me. Versus when someone genuinely laughs at you, right. You feel so validated. You know it immediately.
You know, there's nothing worse than asking someone, a comedian, to define, so what is humor? What is funny? But your book really, you know, takes apart what humor is, why it works. There are obviously so many iterations. But is there something about humor across all those boundaries that sort of connects it together? Why we laugh, why it works?
Oh, it's an interesting question. And I will say that's not the worst thing you can ask a comedian. Okay. The worst thing you can ask a comedian is tell me a joke, because it never goes well after they say that.
Gotcha.
I will say that I think there's an art and a science to laughter and to comedy, right? So there's some magic, and I don't want to lose the magic, which is some part that we can't totally define. But the part that I think we can understand more, scientists at UC Boulder in the Humor Research Lab, which has the acronym HURL, that's their version of a joke, they came up with this idea that what makes us laugh is when there's a benign violation. And so what they mean by that is you break a rule, but you break a rule in a way that is not threatening. So like the classic example is a tickle, right? A tickle is an attack that is benign. And I think a lot of the reason why we laugh is, oh, you crossed a boundary. You did something that's not exactly allowed, but it's not dangerous. It's not offensive. It's just a little over the line. The other thing I think often makes us laugh is a surprise and also recognition. Like, I've always thought that, but I've never exactly defined it that way, is often some of the most satisfying laughs.
You quote George Orwell, and I don't know how much of a sense of humor he had or not, but he says something really interesting. Every joke is a tiny revolution. A joke that really upsets the established order, which is kind of what you were referring to there, which it sort of plays on our expectations and turns them on their head.
Absolutely. And George Orwell, increasingly relevant every day in our world.
Indeed,
so
he is.
A man who is no longer a figure in the past. I think there's a reason that people who wish to consolidate power, who wish to have absolute power, don't like comedy. They don't like laughter. And it's because it encourages us to question the things we take for granted. It encourages us to think that things could be interpreted in different ways. And, you know, there's a reason why autocrats don't like that. I think that's the same reason, though, why when I talked to therapists and psychologists, I interviewed a woman who ran the anxiety lab at University of California. San Francisco. And she said that humor is a really powerful tool in her toolkit as a therapist for anxiety, because it can present the possibility that the way we see things isn't the only way of seeing them. It can introduce a little bit of ambiguity. And that ambiguity can be really powerful in our personal lives, but also in our broader political and professional lives as well.
So do you think people are born funny or develop those skills over time and with practice? And with hard work, probably.
I think I'm going to reject the binary. I think it's both.
Okay.
I think it's not one or the other. I think that you definitely can practice these skills and get better at it. But I also think that the idea that like some people are born with a sense of humor and some people are born without, it doesn't ring true to me, because I worked at an elementary school. If you go to an elementary school, every kid is laughing. Every kid is playing. It's so rare to meet a kid who just never has this sense of laughter and humor and play. That is a very, very rare thing. But as we become adults, we are socialized to do that less, to be less playful, to worry more about what other people think of us. And I think that if we practice the skill of putting ourselves out there a little bit, of letting ourselves be mistaken or imperfect, it can open us up to laughing more, and it can also make our lives so much more enjoyable and fun.
So did teaching fifth graders, did they make you a funnier person?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, my gosh. I mean, teaching fifth graders helped me be a funnier person just because I could come home every day and say the things the fifth graders had said to me, which was always hilarious. I mean, kids would come up all the time with unbelievable sentences, and I would just, my wife is, her, one of her biggest regrets is that I don't teach fifth grade anymore, because every night she would just be like, tell me the things that they said today. You know, kids would come up and ask questions, and they would have the most hilarious questions. Like one time, one that I think about all the time is, we had read a text and it used the phrase sexist pig. And oh. Later on, one of the kids came up to me and said, is it true that pigs hate women? And I was like, I never thought of it that way. I don't think that actual pigs are prejudiced. That is a great question.
Good material, though, for a stand-up comedian, right?
Yes. Well, so there was the obvious great material of what they were actually saying, but there's also the bigger picture, which I've tried to take with me and which I, you know, really want to encourage other people, which is that when we worry a little bit less about whether we look silly or uninformed or unprofessional, we engage more honestly with the world around us. Because like kids are open to saying, I don't know that. Can you help me understand that? And I think adults would benefit from that. But the other is we can have that sense of play, that sense of imaginative creativity that would benefit us. I mean, it would benefit us creatively. It would benefit us professionally. It would help us to come up with new solutions to old problems. So I really do think that it's a necessary thing.
About a minute before our first break here, but why do you think adults eschew play? I mean, that we don't play more. Do we see it as childish?
We have this mistaken idea that people will like us more if we are perfect. If we seem totally put together and perfect, they'll like us more. And yet all of the research shows that we actually like people more and judge them as more competent if they admit that they are imperfect, if they're a little bit of a mess. Like, that's what we want from other people, but we think that that's not what they want from us.
So that we have this sort of silent misunderstanding between each other that we want to play, but we're holding back.
Yeah, I mean, you think that other people will only like you if you are totally fit and in perfect shape and never have a pimple and have a great job and your kids are really impressive. And yet when you meet someone like that, you're like, I hate this person. They're so perfect and intimidating. I don't want to talk to them at all.
Well, let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation with our guest. And his name is Chris Duffy. He's a stand-up comedian and he's also written a new book, and it's titled Humor Me, How Laughing More Can Make You Present, Creative, Connected, and Happy. And we've got much more to talk about after this very short break as we dig into what humor is, what it isn't, and why we need to laugh more. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. People laughing. And we are talking about comedy and humor and laughing today on The Connection. Our guest is Chris Duffy, again, a stand-up comedian, and he's got this new book, Humor Me, where he explores the benefits of cultivating a sense of humor, why laughing is cathartic, contagious, and a sign of cooperation. Well, let's talk about how laughter and humor does connect us to each other. Is it part of those feel-good hormones that just kind of exude when we're laughing and sharing something with someone else?
Sure, I definitely think that's a big part of it. I also think that when we're laughing really hard with someone else, we are so present in the moment with them. Right? Like Marty, let me just turn this around on you for a second.
Sure.
Think about a time when you laughed so hard with someone that tears were running down your face, that you were clutching your sides. Like who was the person that you were laughing with there?
Well, as it turns out, I took several improv classes, and inevitably there, maybe because we were playing, I don't know, but inevitably, mm-hmm. and sort of putting it out there, so kind of scary, just falling apart, laughing on the floor as if we were 7-year-old kids.
100%. Yeah, I think that's such a great example, right? Of like, you're in a class, you're connected, you're kind of putting yourself out
nervous.
There a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're nervous, but you're also like not on your phone. You're not half there, right? You're not answering email or thinking about, hey, what do I have to do for the interview that's coming up tomorrow? And I think that's one of the big, incredible parts of humor is that it's this gift of being totally connected with the other person. And especially when you're laughing that hard, right? You're not anywhere else. You
No.
know that. And I think that's really like something that we need more of, and it is become increasingly rare, is to have that full 100% presence and connection with other people. So this is a way to get back to that.
You also talk about humor as a way of, besides being present, but also observing the world around us. And once you sort of lift your head from your phone or your book, we'll say, seeing things that might surprise us. And you describe, I think you're on a subway, and you looked up and you saw one person was reading a book, How to Talk So People Will Listen, on you know, in one seat, and opposite them was someone reading a book, How to Listen with Intention, which is a great juxtaposition there.
And this is the thing where I saw this and I looked around being like, they must be planted. Surely
right,
this has
exactly.
to be some sort of set. And what it apparently was totally organic. But the other part that shocked me is no one else noticed this. Everyone else was kind of in their own world, totally oblivious to this. And I just thought, one, this is so funny and delightful. I'm going to think about this for the rest of my life. But also, what a shame it is to miss out on moments like this because we aren't actually paying attention to the things happening around us. So I think that, I mean, you asked earlier if humor is something you're born with or not. And
right.
this is where I think it is a practice, right? If we cultivate the ability to, while we are going about our day-to-day, to switch out of autopilot, to not just get into the same rut where we go from home to work, to home to work, to home to work, where we actually see the things that are happening, we can notice more things. That is totally a practice you can cultivate. And when you notice more things, you're going to notice more weird, delightful, odd things. That is such a core piece of humor, is actually just the seeing of it. That's what I want people to do, is to approach the world like that.
And to see the absurdity of so much of life, right? Things that are
totally
absurd.
And ourselves.
And ourselves, yes.
I mean, Marty, you know this from taking an improv class, but if you want to make people laugh and you're in an improv scene, and this is, you know, I'm more interested in people in their regular lives, but this is a performative version. But if you're in an improv scene, the thing that you are looking for is the mistake. The thing you're looking for is the first time that something goes a little bit wrong or isn't said totally perfectly or something weird. And then you take that and you view it as a gift, and it becomes this hilarious seed that can sprout a whole scene or a whole show of comedy. It's not very fun if two people are having breakfast and they just keep eating breakfast. But as soon as someone says, wow, this omelet is rock hard, that becomes the thing that can be funny and can be built on.
Talk a bit about the relationship between, I guess, the joker and the jokey. I mean, you touched on this earlier, but you talk about something, the generous listener, or the inherently generous nature of this interaction, which I found really interesting, but flesh that out for us.
Yeah, I think that, you know, again, people often think of having a great sense of humor as being performative, as the one who is delivering the punchlines. And to me, the thing that is good human skill here is the being able to receive and notice the laugh. And I think often that means recognizing when someone else gives you the gift of saying something really funny and generously laughing at that. I think also, if you notice something really funny or you see something delightful and you share that with someone, that's such a gift. Who doesn't like to receive the information that there's something incredible next to them? Or who doesn't like to, at the end of a hard day, have a huge laugh that just wipes away all the stress of the day? So I think if you do this right, it is such a generous thing. And the flip side, of course, is you can do humor in a way that's very ungenerous, that's
sure.
like bullying and
sure.
mean, right? That's also a possible way of using this.
Well, picking up on that, I mean, that there can be, and so much of it is about tone and delivery, you know, what can at least on paper sound humorous in delivery can be cruel and can be mean.
Totally.
And hateful.
Yeah. I mean, I think a funny thing about like self-help or personal improvement in general is that people often want these like vast universal proclamations, like, right. do this one thing and your life will be better. And especially with humor, it's so context dependent. It's so subjective and person to person dependent. So if I say a sentence to you, it might be really, really funny and delightful. If I say like, okay, Marty, great hat.
Yeah.
You might think that's really funny. And then if I say it to someone who's really self-conscious about their hat, it could be a cruel, mean put down. So you're not wearing a hat right now, which is why I used that example.
But like, just headphones.
You can do the exact same thing in a different context, and it can be either generous or cruel. And I think that's one of the reasons why sometimes people get intimidated by the idea of telling more jokes or having more fun in their lives like this, is because they don't want to step over the line in the wrong way. But I think a lot of us can think and use our instincts to trust, like, when does someone actually feel comfortable and what is playful versus what is over a line?
Well, even larger than that is reading the room, sort of, and knowing one's impact on other people and having that those kind of social and interpersonal skills to know whether a joke would land or maybe land hard.
Totally. And this is why I keep going back to, like, the thing that I would like for people to experiment with, even if they are not, especially if they're not super confident about where the line is not being the one to tell the joke, but the one to appreciate the joke. Like, if you try laughing more when other people are trying to be funny, that is going to go well. That's very hard to go poorly. I think if you try and say the joke and you're not quite sure if it's right or if it's appropriate, like, sometimes that can go wrong. So that's a piece. But I also think the other part is, a lot of what works well is if something naturally comes up and is funny, is then remembering it, paying attention to it, and bringing it back, right? That's how we build these inside jokes and traditions in our families or in our groups, is that, like, you know, one summer you go to the summer vacation with your whole family and someone sits on the couch and it turns out that the couch had a big wet spot on the couch, and they get up and they go, oh no. And then the next year you go, that's okay, right. Watch out. Don't sit on the wet couch. Everyone laughs because it's like, we're bringing that back. And then every year it becomes, got to check the couch for wet spots. You know, it's a silly thing. It's not really like a great joke, but the tradition of bringing it back becomes a part of the culture of the family.
Well, and you know, for lack of a better word, connects people, because they were observers or participants in something that happened, and there was humor involved in it.
Yeah, I mean, like, for me, there's a thing that my family does, and we have a tradition where every summer we go and jump into a very cold river, right?
Oh,
and we do that. And one year, there was like a 14-year-old fishing in the river, and he said, hey, don't jump in the river. You're going to disturb the fish. And we all said, like, we're going to disturb the fish? You have a hook. And now every year we go back, we go, hey, don't disturb the fish, like a fisherman wants to take care of the fish. And we just think about that 14-year-old fishing. We laugh. And it's been years. I mean, literally 5 years since that happened. It still makes us laugh every time.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Chris Duffy, our guest today on The Connection. And he is a stand-up comedian. He's written for television. He's got a podcast as well. And he's got a new book called Humor Me, How Laughing More Can Make You Present, Creative, Connected, and Happy. So why do we laugh when we're nervous or even sometimes angry or afraid? These sort of big, what feel like negative emotions. Why do we sometimes laugh when we're feeling those?
Well, you know, one of the big things that laughter serves is as a social lubricant. It fills these moments where we're a little uncomfortable or where there's a pause. When scientists look at conversations and they just look where laughter comes up, the majority of laughs don't come after anything that is even by a stretch viewed as a joke. It's instead filling a pause or connecting us to other people. So laughter has this kind of social purpose of just helping us to connect a little bit and smooth over the rough patches. But I think the other part is, laughter is a way of trying to connect with other people, right? So if you're scared and you start laughing, you're like, this isn't actually as bad as I think it is, right? And hopefully the other person laughs with you, and then you know, like, I wasn't actually that scared. So I think we're reaching out, and if we can connect with someone else, that laughter is a way to know that we're being held and seen.
In fact, you describe comedy clubs tend to be very small. People are packed in, often low ceilings. People are side by side, you know, very in close quarters, as a way of what, enhancing the contagion of laughter?
Totally. I mean, the more that we stop thinking about ourselves and just are part of the group, the more we laugh. So if you're dark, if you're packed in, if the ceiling is low, we laugh more. And part of that is because we stop thinking, like, what will other people think about us? But the other part is, laughter is kind of magic in that it's contagious. Not many of our social interactions, right? If one person sneezes, everyone doesn't else start sneezing. But if you laugh, it's much more likely that the people around you are going to laugh. The only other thing that's very comparable is a yawn.
I was just going to say, except for yawning. Right, right.
Yeah, so, you know, I'm sure that there's some sort of sleep club where you could figure out the way to maximize yawning together. It'd probably be that you have to be really bright so you could see everyone yawning. But in a comedy club, the darkness and the proximity make us laugh more. And I think that's something you can take out of the comedy club and bring into your, like, a regular person's practical life in thinking, like, how can I, if I want to laugh more, if I want to have more fun in my life, how can I find ways to get outside of monitoring myself, of thinking, what do people think of me? What do I look like right now? And how can you put yourself where you're just part of the group, you're going with the flow, and you're really experiencing things?
How do you prepare for stand-up comedy? Are there certain things you do to get, either to read the room or to get yourself into a certain mindset or emotional equilibrium or whatever?
Yeah, the emotional equilibrium I try and get myself into is, this is gonna go badly and that's okay.
Why
this
did I say
fine.
Yes? Yes.
Yes. Why did I agree to this? Oh no. I think that I do that. The other thing I try and do is I try and do the thing where I try and switch off the part of my brain that says, I'm paying attention to everything you say and I'm judging you. I try and switch off that voice a little bit and to instead get into the flow state as much as possible and to really focus on the connection rather than the potential failure. So, you know, a thing I love about stand-up as an art form is that if I write a book, if I paint a painting, it takes a long time for me to know what the audience thinks about that. But if you tell a joke, you instantly know. They either laugh or they don't. So there's this very short feedback loop. And it's really fun to be able to pivot in the moment and to try something else. You know, sometimes audiences are more into one type of joke than other, and you can pivot quickly.
Yeah, and you can you sort of read the laughter, sort of know this is landing, this is half landing, gotta make some moves here.
Yeah, the same way. I mean, you know, Marty, when you're in a conversation with someone, when you're in an interview, you know if we're connected, right? Oh, it doesn't feel like this is really, we're kind of in a rote conversation, or we are locked in and we're actually deeply connected. And I think this is kind of that same thing, just on a broader scale. Is am I connecting and really hitting what people view as the truth? Or am I saying something where, for some reason, we are at odds? We're not actually seeing the same reality.
You talk about the rule of threes. And this is, in part, how this works in comedy. What is the rule of threes?
So the rule of threes is that things are funniest if you bring them back three times. So if something's funny, you bring it back a second time, it gets a big laugh. And then you bring it back a third time, it gets the biggest laugh. Now, you'd think if you brought it back a fourth time, hey, a good thing. How could it not be better? But it tends to get diminishing returns. People are like, yeah, okay, you're beating a dead horse. And I think once I learned this, you start seeing it everywhere. You see it in comedy sketches on TV. You see it in books. You see it in advertisements. You see it in all these really delightful ways where something gets introduced, it gets returned to, and then it gets brought back a final time. And, you know, I think one of the reasons why that is so funny is because once is a point, the second is a line, and then the third is a pattern. And we love a pattern. And four, it's like we already get the pattern.
Got it.
It's not as interesting after that.
I was actually thinking of the car guys, you know, the late, great car guys, who had a show on public broadcasting. I think they came out of Boston.
Yeah, Car Talk was incredible.
Yeah, Car Talk. And their law firm was Dewey, Cheatham and Howe, you know.
A great joke.
Yeah, a great joke, and they're the threes, right?
Yeah, Dewey, Cheatham and Howe. It's funnier because it is three. I don't know exactly why. There's just this thing that it tickles in our brain. Yeah, it's interesting, Marty. You're a real appreciative person of comedy, and you like to perform comedy as well. I sense that that's a thing for you, right?
Well, you know, it's
you
funny.
Like to make people laugh.
I like to make people laugh, but I cannot tell a joke.
Okay.
As soon as I hear one, I forget it. I always forget the end. I have friends who tell unbelievable amount of jokes, and I kind of, you know, laugh along. I'm a good audience, but at the same time, I've never sort of mastered the art of delivering a joke. I don't believe in it for me, for whatever
reason.
Totally. Yeah.
I kind of think that people who are really good at telling jokes often are, they can get tiring very fast, right? You're like, after two or three jokes, you're like, that's enough jokes.
Okay, time up.
Whereas the people who really like laugh in conversation and you get stuff going and then you're just laughing so hard and you're really like, it's about the genuine thing that you can't even repeat or explain afterwards. That to me is that's the magic that you can't, You can't create in any other way.
What's your opinion of puns and dad jokes and the eye rolling that often comes with those?
We'll talk about a leading question. Ask you about the eye rolling. I was going to say I love them. I'm a dad. I like a dad joke.
Yeah, of course.
You know, my favorite genre of dad jokes is not the puns. My favorite genre of dad jokes is something I call table bits, which is like the thing that you do if you're out at a restaurant. So like the very big dad joke is the server comes and your plate is totally empty and you go, oh, we hated it.
Yeah.
You know,
I've done that, actually.
Or it's like a baby at the table and you go, put it on his card. Like I love those kind of dad jokes because everyone groans and they're like, please stop doing this. You're humiliating us, dad. But that always makes me laugh. I think that like puns and any type of joke, if you're doing it and it's bringing joy to you and the people around you, more power to you. And if you're doing it and it's actually pushing people away, then you should not be doing it, right? Like read the room, use it to connect. You don't have to necessarily find the pun in everything. And I do think sometimes pun people, they run into this problem where they are looking at every sentence someone says to them as like a puzzle to be solved, or where can I put the wordplay in, rather than actually reacting to the content of the sentence, right? So someone says like, I'm having a really hard day, and they go, hard day. Wow, Hard Day's Night, the Beatles album. And you're like, what are you talking about? I was telling you I was having a hard day.
Well, I have to confess, because I live with someone who does pun, and I've asked him about it a lot. But I think for him, it's his brain is, like you say, constantly turning things over, finding, you know, moving words around and discovering, you know, something, of course, that he thinks is clever and hilarious.
Yeah, well, that's also, I love the phrasing of, I have to confess, I live with someone who puns. the dark disgrace of, I have a pun in my house, and the pun won't go away. Yeah. You know, I would much rather have someone who puns than have someone who is completely serious and refuses to see the lightness or play in the world.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, absolutely. I mean, because it is playful, even
totally.
If it's obsessive.
Exactly. And sometimes we have to laugh at the level of obsessiveness we have.
And I know he's listening. Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation with Chris Duffy. He's a stand-up comedian and he's got a new book we've been talking about called Humor Me, How Laughing More Can Make You Present, Creative, Connected, and Happy. We've got much more to talk about after this very short break, including some newscasters losing it. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and just a recap here, it can be tough to find something to laugh about these days, and yet laughter is good for our health. Our guest is a stand-up comedian, Chris Duffy, host of the podcast How to Be a Better Human, and again, he's got a new book, Humor Me, How Laughing More Can Make You Present, Creative, Connected, and Happy. I want to play another clip, and this is just a news anchor losing it live on TV, reading a story about a pig.
One pot-bellied pig has certainly endured his share of problems. Chris P. Bacon was born without the use of his... you have to read this story.
So, Chris, why are we sitting here laughing with a guy who's laughing about a pig on TV?
I mean, it's amazing to me is I don't know what he was saying.
I didn't
even see him laughing. I have no context, and it still is really funny. So, I mean, the shortest answer is that we are programmed evolutionarily to laugh at other people laughing. It's a contagious thing. It's so delightful to have other people laugh. And the other part is, you know, it's so rare, especially with the news, for us to be like, that's a funny, light story. So we're like, thank God there's something funny. I love the story about crispy bacon instead of the other stories. and that's not to say they're not important, but I think that there's just something so wonderful about seeing other people laugh. And that's why I think humor is generous. It's like we appreciate seeing other people do it, and we love when it happens for us too.
Well, and the idea of news anchors who are often so buttoned up to see them absolutely losing it on live TV. I mean, that's a gift.
We are still all the children in the class who just want to see the teacher make a mistake. You know, you want to see the serious figure go have a break a little bit. You want to crack the seriousness of how the world works. Yeah. And I think also a thing that I try really hard in my own life to do that is inspired by humor is to think about, like, where are the scripts that I am following that I am supposed to, and I put that in quotes, supposed to be following. And what if I didn't follow them? And that's not to say, like, I do some sort of giant antisocial breaking of the norms, but just to say, like, do I actually have to be this serious? Do I actually have to approach this as though it is only sad and bad and depressing? What if I introduced a little more ridiculousness? What if I was a little more playful and silly? How would it go if I approached it with that as a possibility? And I think that's why, like, seeing other people laugh when they're not supposed to, it's fun.
Yeah.
And we want to do that for ourselves too.
Indeed. Let me ask you a little bit about, I guess you and your wife went through a scary time. You write about that in the book, where she was quite ill and it was unclear what the diagnosis was, and clearly a dark time for the both of you. How, and I guess maybe even when was humor, was levity, was laughter? When did that feel right for if either the two of you or maybe for her or for you?
Yeah, I think often when we're in these really overwhelming times, like I was, it can just be like laughter disappears, right? Like, how could you possibly laugh? It's not available. And for me, I mean, the specific thing that happened with my wife that made us laugh after we hadn't laughed for a really long time is she was kind of desperately grabbing at straws of what could make me feel better, what's a possibility. And she, you know, said, like, maybe I need to go to a silent meditation retreat and live in the woods and be away from society. And I said, you know, you are really not independent right now. I'm caretaking for you and we're seeing all these doctors. I don't think that you being off the grid all alone is a very good idea. And she said, like, oh no, you would come with me. And the idea of me, a person who is the chattiest person in the world, who talks nonstop, going to a silent meditation retreat for a month while I was already overwhelmed, both of us just burst into laughter at the idea of me, like, desperately trying to communicate without being able to use words. So it wasn't like laughing then solved the problem, right? It didn't heal my wife's pain. It didn't make us understand what was going on with her. It didn't even make me less overwhelmed. But it took that moment and it took the tension out of it. And it transformed the way that we both were perceiving that particular little moment into something that was like light and a moment of connection. And for me, that was a thing that let me get through that day and that week. And sometimes that's all that we really need, is just to get through that particular painful moment.
I think humor
can do that.
Yeah. And it's a great story too, you know.
Oh yeah. Thank you. Well, especially now in retrospect.
Yes,
you know,
of course.
Comedy, we often talk about this rule of, there's a formula that comedians often talk about, which is that tragedy plus time equals comedy.
Yeah,
because
we're
so much more often able to see the funny or see the ridiculousness when it's in the past than when we're living through it.
You know, you asked me about a time when I was laughing uproariously, and I was thinking that has happened at funerals, and it's not like laughing at the dead person. I mean, there's a lot of sadness and loss and grief and crying and all of that, but there are these moments, and often with people, where maybe you're telling stories or whatever, where again you sort of lose all your inhibitions and the laughter just pours out of you.
Totally. And I mean, so often the times when we laugh the hardest are when we're not supposed to. When someone says don't laugh, like,
yes,
you're in the classroom and you're trying not to laugh, then the trying not to makes it even more heightened. And I think that, again, like, there's this script that we are supposed to follow, this social script at a funeral, that is, this is supposed to just be sad. And yet so few people's lives are just sad when they're gone. They're also joyful and full of contradictions and ridiculousness and absurdity, right? Like, people contain all of those things. And so we can be sad that we've lost them, and we can also acknowledge the fun and funny and ridiculous parts of them. I think that actually makes it more authentic and feel like real rather than scripted and false and kind of phony.
And even laughing together, knowing it's sort of subversive to be doing it, but to have, you know, have a gang laughing at a funeral has a weird sense of connection.
I actually, you know, I see why you said the word weird, but I think that is not weird at all. In fact, I think that's the reason why, like, if you are a person who works a really stressful job, right, like you're an emergency room doctor or you're a soldier or you're a firefighter, those people often have such great senses of humor and they laugh with each other. And I think one of the big reasons why that is because when you laugh with someone else, it's because you both get it. Yeah. And that's so what we need when we're in these moments, is to know, like, I'm not the only one, right? It's such a powerful thing to connect with someone else who gets it. And that's why it's actually not as funny if, like, you're an emergency room doctor and someone who has no experience in the emergency room make the joke. You go, well, you don't actually get it. That's not funny. But if the other doctor makes the joke, then yes, we know we're connected. So at the funeral, it's like, we all are grieving. We're allowed to make this joke and we're allowed to connect.
You referenced this earlier, but I want to just dig in a little deeper about dictators not liking comedians. But you also write about the role of the court jester. As we know, they often were allowed to make fun of the king. They had the permission to do that, say things that other people were not allowed to say. Is that how you see maybe late night comedians playing that role these days?
I think that sometimes late night comedians can play that role. I think satire is a very important way of pointing out truth to power, right? The story that I'm sure we all know is, you know, the emperor has no clothes.
Yes.
And it's easy to be the person who goes, I guess he must be wearing clothes. And I think the jester is the one who goes, this guy is naked. Hey, we're looking at a naked guy. And sometimes we need that. And, you know, I think historically, the jesters are an interesting thing because they pointed out truth to power, but they were also a way for the emperor or the Shah or the king to diffuse tension so that they didn't lose power, to say, like, I will accept some criticism, but not all. So there is this interesting line where, you know, sometimes it serves the interests of the powerful to let themselves be laughed at in a particular way. And other times it's very important that we do point out the ridiculousness.
Well, maybe I'll let you make fun of me, but not you, right?
Definitely. Yeah. Some people lose their head for the same joke that
exactly,
the jester gets
exactly
fed for. So I think it's important. And, you know, historically, there are many examples of times where repressive regimes have been undermined, not entirely. It's never just jokes, but the idea that we can see that this is not totally logical, that everyone doesn't agree, that's actually a very powerful initial force in overturning a repressive regime. Vaclav Havel talked about this, wrote a play that was very funny. Vaclav Havel talked about how he wrote a play that was very funny, and the audience laughed at parts that they were not supposed to laugh at under the regime. And that laughter was the realization for everyone there of, oh, everyone else feels this way. And that was a really important moment for them to start thinking about, maybe we're not alone in recognizing the ridiculousness of how we are currently being ruled.
Oh, that's a terrific story. You quote Roy Wood Jr. was a show on CNN called You've Got to Be Kidding.
No. Have I Got News for You?
Have I Got News for You? He says comedy as journalism. And I thought that was really, sort of picking up on what we're talking about here as a way of commenting on what's going on in the world.
Yeah, Roy is a really interesting person to me, both because I think he's one of the most talented stand-up comedians performing today, but also because his father was a pioneering civil rights journalist. He reported in South Africa. He reported in the civil rights movement in the United States. So Roy grew up in this house where the importance of journalism and the importance of acknowledging what is happening in society was really drilled into him. And then Roy became this incredible stand-up comedian who was a correspondent on The Daily Show and now has this show on CNN. And Roy talks about, like, if you get people to laugh at something, you're getting them to both pay attention to it and to agree with an idea about it. So we have to think really carefully about where we're directing that focus. And to pretend that it doesn't have power is to deny the reality of it. That's what he says. And I really agree with him.
Yeah. Let me ask you about, I'm thinking of Bill Maher, but there are other comedians who have criticized audiences or even the culture today, saying that people they're overly sensitive and you can't say this and no one laughs at that. How do you see that critique?
I mean, I kind of think it's ridiculous because the people who always say, like, you can't say this, are the ones saying it on national platforms, right? It's like, oh no, they won't let you say anything. Well, you're saying it to millions of people on television and you're being paid so much money to say it. So I'd believe that a lot more if it was like, he was writing that on Post-it notes and passing them out of the jail window.
Right.
I think that then I'd be like, wow, you really can't say anything. But to me, I think that we are, the idea that we are allowed to say anything without consequence seems ridiculous, right? Like, people can be upset at us, and that's not a problem. That's just the nature of human communication. That
sure.
If you want to talk to people, you
sure.
have to accept that they might have different opinions. That's how I view it.
Rather than censoring
everyone's. Well, I don't think it's censoring to say everyone doesn't have to agree with you.
Right.
That's what I would say.
Right.
Right. Like, it seems like sometimes people want to be able to say, like, I have a giant national platform and everyone has to agree with me. And I'm like, well, that's, you know, that would be nice. I wish I had that. I wish people paid me millions of dollars and everyone thought I was a genius. I'd take that deal. But I think that that's not necessarily how reality works.
Let me ask you about what I would describe as either Jewish humor or Irish humor, or even mm-hmm. what they, at least as an outside observer, have in common. And I remember going to Ireland and I felt like, I think everyone here is sort of part Jewish just because of the humor, the storytelling, the suffering, obviously, the literature, the culture. It all felt that the humor came out of all the struggles that they had had to stay alive and keep their culture alive.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'll say first as a disclaimer here, my name is Chris Duffy, so I've got the Irish part, but then my mom is Jewish.
Oh,
so
okay,
you wouldn't know
you
that.
Go.
She named her son Christopher. So I'm half. So you really nailed both sides of it.
I did.
A funny story about that is that my mom didn't realize until I was 3 years old why no other people at the synagogue had a son named Christopher. And then they were like, the first part is Christ. And she was like, oh, wow. Okay, I get it now. I didn't do my due diligence. But I think that, you know, the Irish, historically oppressed people, the Jewish, historically a victim of much violence and repression. And I think that not just those two groups, but across the world, when you look at oppressed peoples, when you look at peoples who have experienced a lot of suffering, often the response to suffering is not to be depressing and sad and serious, but is instead to laugh and to create humor. And because that's a survival mechanism, I think it lets us get through the worst parts of it and lets us bond with each other and understand that, like, they can take away all this other stuff, but they can't take away our joy. And that's something that I think we can all benefit from, for sure.
And joy and grief, you know, often going hand in hand.
Oh, they're two sides of the same coin so often. And, you know, I think the line between laughing and crying is not, it's not a bright line. Often we laugh until we cry, and sometimes we cry until we laugh. I think that this is, you can hold multiple truths at the same time. And I think that that is something that is not, at this moment in our society and culture, people don't love the idea that you can hold multiple seemingly contradictory beliefs and truths at the same time. And I think it's actually something that is fantastic about humor and laughter in these cultures, is to realize, like, it doesn't have to just be sad or just be funny or just be tragic or just be victorious. It can be a combination of all of the above.
We're more than the A or the B. I'm curious about who, as a kid growing up, who you listened to, who you watched, who you found funny.
Oh, wow. Well, I mean, I loved Mr. Bean growing up.
Mr. Bean. Oh, wow.
Like, I still think that getting your head stuck in a turkey, that's about the funniest thing you can do. I'm a big believer in falling down as a funny thing that you can do. I think as I got older, I really liked, you know, I like some of the classic comedians, right? Like Carlin, or I also have... I was a big fan of Jim Carrey and the Jim Carrey movies. Oh, wow. But I mean, to me, the funniest people have always been not famous people. The funniest people have always been my friends and my family members who make me laugh so hard that I'm spitting, you know, water out of my nose. And again, I think that's why, like, I'm most interested not in performative comedy. There's so many people who are more talented and more successful than me at, like, the job of stand-up comedian. What I'm really interested in is, like, how do you laugh with the people around you? How do you walk through the world and see funny things? Because that's what I enjoy the most, is I want to see the thing that my friend Ivan is going to point out and that we're both going to laugh about for the next 10 years. And it's okay that I don't see him on Netflix. I prefer that I see him on
your
my
living
front
room.
Doorstep instead. Yeah.
Well, on that note, we got to leave it there. It's been such fun, Chris Duffy. Thank you for joining us today on The Connection.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. This was an absolute pleasure.
A pleasure for us as well. And again, he's a stand-up comedian and he's an author. He's got a new book, Humor Me, How Laughing More Can Make You Present, Creative, Connected, and Happy. He's also got a podcast, How to Be a Better Human. And thank you for joining us today on The Connection, which airs every Friday and Sunday at noon right here on WHYY. You can download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts, and you can listen on the WHYY app. You can also follow The Connection on Instagram and find the show on Facebook. And you can check out our website, WHYY.org/The Connection, for information about upcoming shows and how to sign up for our newsletter. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of the show. Debbie Builder produces The Connection. Again, thanks for joining us.